I'm Christopher Lydon, picking up the thread of the new India with the most eminent Indian outside the subcontinent, Amartya Sen, in his living room outside Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one with India's first Nobel Prize winner in economics, though Amartya Sen is the rare scientific economist who is still better known for breakthrough ideas about famine, population, women's rights, and the philosophical foundations of justice. Amartya Sen, in our Year of India conversations, we're getting to know a country quite unlike the India you grew up in, not Gandhi's India, not Nehru's India, not the neutralist old nation of villages. You've known all the modern players. You're part of the history in your own experience. Mark the changes that really count.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for welcoming me here. I think what's happening is a mixture. The India I knew as a child is also there, but there are other elements which were not present that much. I was born in British India. I did my schooling in British India, so there was a different world. But also, in the world, there is greater understanding of India in a way that wasn't earlier. I mean, this applies everywhere. I mean, in America, when I first came here, I was quite shocked. This doesn't apply to England. But in America, it was quite striking that pretty much everyone knew something about ancient China. And pretty much and nobody knew anything at all, that there was even an ancient India, in any sense. Now, that is a new change. And it's odd for those who are interested in ancient India, as I am, as an old-fashioned Sanskritist, that the recognition that there was an ancient India has come mainly to modern India. It's because of the success of the Silicon Indians and such, that suddenly people take India more seriously, then look back at history. And then all those things people go on saying now, it has an accounting culture that goes back for 5,000 years. That's true, because 3,000 BC, the Indus Valley Civilization, most of the writing records, and that's not a point of glory, I think, are accounts. So the fact that 5,000 years ago Indians were doing accounting, some people have seen it as a great sign that it was bound to be a business success. So I think ancient India, interest in ancient India in America, particularly, but West in general, have come through unsuspecting routes and unsuspecting ways. But nevertheless, since it was there and it's a part of India's present reality, ancient India affects India in all kinds of ways. And so I'm glad that that recognition has broadened. But it's only part of it is that India is changing. Part of it, the recognition of India is changing too.
It took the Manmohan Singh visit to the White House, and you were there, for it to dawn on me that, wow, the capitalist revolution that we sort of know in China is 20 years old in India.
Yeah.
And itself constitutes a huge change.
Well, it is a big change, Chris, and I'm delighted you raised that question, because there are three aspects of it that one should distinguish, I think. One is that there have always been a business culture in India for a long, long time. Indians did business pretty much everywhere in the world. Well before the British, well before the Portuguese. Indeed, the arrival of the Europeans was connected with Indian trading. And even though, you know, the fact that if you think about Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, the languages have huge elements of Sanskrit. I mean, many of the words are Sanskrit words, actually. That the fact that, I mean, like Singapore, Sanskrit for City of Lions, and so on. Really? So all these are, all that spread was connected partly with colonization, but primarily with trade. I think the Indians were trading from about 2nd century AD in a big way everywhere. In fact, one of the Chinese visitors to Central Asia, he inquired, how did these Chinese goods, why do we find these Chinese goods in Turkmenistan, asked this man. And then he inquired, and then he was told some Indian traders brought it from China to Turkmenistan. That's about 300 BC. So they have been doing that thing, and business culture had been part of it. And all those people who say Westerners is materialist and business-oriented, Indians are spiritualist and thought-oriented, are talking absolute nonsense. And this is a part of the culture. Now, that's one point. The second point is that the when the Indians were trying to get into modern industries in the 19th century, and, you know, Tatars were among the first to succeed, there were other firms, cotton textile came up. But by and large, they found a very unfriendly British rule there. Yeah. Because mainly it was competing with Britain a great deal. And even though it was very unfashionable when, at the time when I was undergraduate in Cambridge, just after the British rule, to talk that a political control could have played a part, I don't think anyone will deny that. Mm. And it's peculiar. For example, the Tatars had a hugely difficult time starting their industry with the Tata Naga Jamshedpur, the steel mill, which produced a million tons of steel eventually. There was a very little support, and eventually it's only under one viceroy, namely Lord Curzon, he got some support, and it was possible for him to go ahead. Now, when one thinks about it, it's peculiar when the Tata, the same Tata family, bought the almost entire British steel industry, as it did 3 years ago, in the form of Korat, that there was a peculiar changing of hat. And I did think that the Financial Times got it quite right in its editorial. And it says, well, for, overlooking the British Indian days, but these days, whenever there is any foreign investment in India, so many Indians are always agitating about foreign control about India. But they have to sometimes bear in mind that they have been able to buy our entire steel industry without anyone raising a political objection to it. And FT, as often, was exactly right, I think, on that. The third thing is that while the Indian business is old, the new aspect of the Indian business is its connection with America, very importantly.
And Silicon Valley, right?
And
Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley in particular. But, you know, there was also biotech. But you see, these were offshoots of Indians coming mostly to America. Americans don't get enough credit for it, that they provided scholarship, they provided support. The Americans don't get enough credit for the fact that the ever-successful IITs, which were the brainchild of Nehru, certainly. He actually longed for them.
These Indian Institutes of Technology.
Indian Institutes of Technology. Sorry, I should explain that. But that was, in fact, helped. It was MIT initially, and then a number of American universities played a part in doing it. So Americans make a huge contribution in the development of the high-tech part, and they were very much American clones. And increasingly, you see the impact of it, that the upper class and the middle class Indian speak increasingly English with an American tang in it, as opposed to British tang in it. And so I think that's another thing. But so sitting here in Boston, where we are sitting this moment, the perception looks even stronger than it does fitting in London, because of the fact that the American part is new and it deals with the most dynamic part of the Indian economy.
So 3 points for background. A, it's an old trading, robust, almost imperial manufacturing culture before the Brits. Second, deeply enmeshed with Britain's economy even today. And then churned up enormously by American technology, too.
I mean, on the first point, just to elaborate additionally, I mean, that's a very good summary. But the first point, that when people like Adam Smith and others are talking about the prosperity of Bengal in 18th century, that part of India where I actually happen to come from. My family is from Bangladesh, but West Bengal, East Bengal, all that Bangladesh. I mean, that is a hugely manufacturing area, producing textile, exporting to the whole world. And all pretty much all the trading firms that went there first.
That piece of India's industrial past is, of course, suppressed by the British story of what was going on in the 18th, 19th century, which leads me to another matter. Nehru, in his book on the discovery of India, quotes an unnamed Englishman who he said was well acquainted with India, confessing this. He said, "Our writing of India's history is perhaps resented more than anything else we have done." including that industrial history, can you summarize a sort of revised conversational narrative of the Indian past?
Yeah, and in the British eyes, particularly.
Well, revision of the British view.
Yeah. Well, I don't know who the particular person is that Nehru is quoting who notices that something in the British writing offended Indians very much. But I can tell you who was the biggest offender of that, namely James Mill, John Stuart Mill's father, early utilitarian, a great follower of Jeremy Bentham, and a very oppressive man, actually, in many ways. And one of the people don't get enough credit, give enough credit to John Stuart Mill. I mean, the greatest achievement of John Stuart Mill is to be halfway intelligent and independent-minded, having the kind of dad that he had. But then again, of course, he was a bit more than that, since he's one of my heroes. But
James Mill was an officer of the East India Company, was he not?
Well, that wasn't the only issue, because a lot of the East India Company officers were hugely supportive of studies of India. 19th century is the real home of racism in that period. And the spectacular thing was James Mill's History of India, his History of British India. He wrote this in a 3-volume history without ever having visited India. He was very proud of that fact, because he also had a theory that had he visited India, he would have become biased. So it was one of his great achievements that he wrote this history without actually knowing a single Indian or any Indian language. But there you find how Indian culture was one of the lowest that you could imagine in Western standards. On the other hand, he did acknowledge that it was just, actually, he was, since the Indian culture was taught to be rather high, he said, no, it's almost as low. There's a lovely sentence, which I quote in my book, Argumentative India, where he says, "It's Indian culture is almost at the same primitive level as the culture of other backward nations, like Japan, China, and the Arab world." So that at one go, James Mill had got the entire non-Western world under his toes. Now, naturally, not only Indians, but also a lot of others didn't like that writing. And I think that became the Bible. Macaulay, who was one of the big figures in governing India, thought that James Mill's book in history was the most important book in history ever written, next to Gibbon's. And it was compulsory reading for any company officer, and later any British administrator going to India. When they would be trained in Britain, they had to read James Mill's history. So that vitiated an understanding. It generated a lot of the nationalist movement too. The fact that nationalist movement recruits very often came from the university intellectual groups, and especially trained lawyers, often trained barristers coming back from London. It was much influenced by the fact that James Mill and others, Macaulay, when saying that a single shelf of a European library contained greater wisdom than the whole library of India and Arabia put together. That or the whole history of publication there. So that kind of contributed to disaffection. Nehru is talking about that by quoting some Englishman who probably understood it. I don't know who that would be.
So what I'm wondering is, given the British sort of bumper sticker history of India as a primitive people somehow rescued by English machinery and trade, what is the short form new Indian conception of its own past? How do even you sort of see the pattern from ancient India to a world role today?
Well, you see, this is where it's important to have some view oneself of philosophy of history. That is, there's a huge variety of things happening in India. And I think if there was anything distinctive, it's the variety and the tolerance of variety. I think if there was anything that India could be really proud of, it's not just the fact that 3000 BC they were already writing, and is the single script in that period which is written from left to right rather than from right to left. So there was something quite distinctive about it, which doesn't easily get traced only to Sumeria and Mesopotamia. But it's at the same time, and there's a hugely settled agricultural and township culture with good city planning. As one of the great architects, Martin Wheeler, said, the level of city hygienic planning in 3000 BC is a level which is not only admirable, but a level to which India had not ever reached since then.
Oh, wow.
And I think he was quite right. And I often thought of that as I passed open drains in Calcutta. But of course, Martin Wheeler could have also said that the British have contributed a little to neglecting this altogether. So I think the Indians are proud of that, but the Indians should be really reason to proud of the tolerance of variety. I mean, pretty much everywhere persecuted people came to India. Jews arrived there shortly after the fall of Jerusalem from 1st century AD, they are there. There's a Jewish story saying Ben Israelis were there earlier also, but certainly by 1st century they were there in large numbers, big settlement. Then the Christians came in 3rd and 4th century AD. Then as soon as persecution began in Iran, the Zoroastrians came and made up the thriving Parsi community in India. And there was a whole group, and also some of the disaffected Muslim population, when there was a difference between them, came and settled in the west coast of India. So there had been a long history, and this is well before the Muslim conquest of India. These are Muslim traders escaping persecution at home. Hmm. And the Baha'is are the largest, is the latest movement of that, and the largest number of Baha'is were, of course, also in India. That's a long history. I think this is something we're proud of. I think this is one of the great things. But at the same time, to recognize is that tolerance of variety makes it very difficult to see India in a unitary perspective. Mm. And I think it's more than that. And that's where philosophy of history comes in. When two sides are arguing, even if one side vanquishes the other, something of each side remains. A vanquished argument is still an argument. It just happens to be vanquished.
Interesting.
And therefore, when you have to take the to history of India, as I try to argue in my book, Argumentative Indian, which was published by Penguin many years ago, and that was, the argument was that it is, in fact, it is an argumentative culture, and each side of the argument, there is something that's true in the truly representative. Now, not all of the positions may be correct if they're contradictory to each other, but the fact that these views are held in India would be correct. Mm. And they're not gone away because somebody defeated an argument. They still continue to be there. So I think if you take all that into account, you get a very plural view of the history of India. And that includes great strides in intellectual activities, as well as great illiteracy in other parts of the country, and same parts of the country, depending on classes. You get huge tolerance on one side, and basically a tolerant culture, and yet every now and then there will be a movement saying, we don't want foreigners. But happily, they never ultimately won. Then you see also very devout Hindus, very devout Christians, very devout Muslims, quite a lot of the so-called Wahhabi sect of the intolerant Muslims group, which is now blamed with this, that particular offshoot of the Sunni group, which is often blamed with terrorism, that originated also in India and UP. Mm. And so all these are part of Indian culture. There's no way one can deny that.
Amartya Sen, you know, trying to get our American heads around the new India, I'm just reminded of Harold Isaacs. Maybe 50 years ago, he wrote about American impressions of China and India. And he said, we only had maybe four or five Indian stereotypes to play with in those days. There were the Maharajas, or flying around on carpets. There were sadhus, the holy men. There were magicians. There were beggars, but not much more. Nowadays, in addition, we have the Hindu nationalists. We have religious fanatics. We have the Maoist anti-globalizers. We have the Bangalore billionaires, of course. We have Bollywood. Who do you see in modern India as the representative types or names or roles that we have to get to know?
Well, you know, Chris, there's so many different types there. I mean, even Harold Isaac's book is a wonderful one. I remember reading it with great care and admiration and enlightenment. But even at that time, of course, there were exceptions. I mean, Gandhi is a big exception. Gandhi had pretty good press in India, in America, rather better than in India. I think some of his other aspects get much more critical attention in India than it did here. The fact that he was against modern industries, he was even against railways, which make him a pretty retrograde thinker. I've never seen come up in public discussions here. So I think Harold Isaac's point book made the right point, but exaggerated a bit. There were some political leaders which were recognized, and Gandhi was preeminently the one, but there were others. There were also already at that time a number of academics who were well-known in the world in fields of math. Ramanujan was already a great name in physics. Chandrasekhar was not exactly Isaac's time, but within a few years of that, was being, you know, he's having craters named after him in the moon because of the Americans when they were sending rockets around it and taking over all the names. Some of them are called Chandra this or Chandra that. Bose, certain Bose who worked with Einstein, of course, bosons that are known world across the world, half the particles in the world are named after certain Bose from Calcutta, whom I knew quite well personally because he was a wonderful man. I was a very young man then. So there was also, and in the scientific group, they were known. Jagdish Chandra Bose was another one. So there were figures that. So these were the additional traditional ones. But then, of course, they have a whole lot of people now, business executives, business gurus who are advising people also how to run your business with success. Then the psychological charmers, whether they're doing in terms of attracting you to their little ashram or whether they are telling you how to quieten your mind while you stay in the United States. And even when I was absolutely impressed to see one of the Indian origin books explaining why even when you're driving on a motorway, a freeway in California, you should be able to meditate. Now, I did think that there is going things a little too far. I would like people not to meditate at that moment. And so
we have to mention the writers too. I mean, Salman Rushdie.
And I was just going to say.
And Vikram Seth.
And Arundhati Roy. And Amitabh Ghosh. A number of them whom I would regard as great writers. And the film people, of course. Satyajit Ray, even at Harold Isaac's time, Pathir Panchali was getting introduced, and then there was a great success. Ultimately, when the recognition from Hollywood came from Lifetime Achievement, he was already a great hero across the world, and there are a number of film producers. Now, the reason why Bollywood is known is not necessarily for great directing, but having provided a different kind of entertainment. And it took some time for it to be established as a legitimate form of entertainment. But as it happened, it's been success. Its success was first, very often people forget, in Africa was a great hit. Middle East was a great hit. Before it became a reasonable hit in Europe and in America too. I remember being lectured by a Nigerian taxi driver from when he was driving me from Logan Airport in Boston to my home near Harvard Square. And he was so upset by my level of my abysmal ignorance of Indian film that he started lecturing me on the ABC of that. And since the lecture wasn't finished by the time I reached home, he actually took a detour and explained to me that this is another way of getting there. But he was bent on finishing his lecture, which he did. And I must say, I ever since remain grateful because I learned a hell of a lot in that taxi ride. Straight from Nigeria, I've just been there for about 5 years in Boston at that time. So I think the Indians were spreading out, and there was, in a sense, it has always been a culture that receptive of things coming from outside and willing to go abroad. There are occasional moments of blackout, which are not part of glory of Indian history. But by and large, the open open Indians have tended to prevail over closed Indians. And that's a battle still. The open Indians are having to battle the closed Hindu view of India. The fact that 82% of Indians may be Hindus doesn't change the openness. Even now it's true that the Prime Minister is not Hindu, Sikh. The leader of the ruling party is a Christian, born in Italy, Christian background certainly. And a few years ago it was also true that the third of the big force you can think of, namely the President of India, was also a Muslim. So that there was not a single representation of the majority community of 82% among any of the three leadership positions.
But is that what you mean by open India?
No, open India is a much broader concept. But a part of the reflection of open India is the willingness to accept that you don't have to belong to the mainstream in order to be counted as a genuine Indian. As Rabindranath Tagore said in two very quite famous statements, one, that anything that we admire, even if it's admire, come to like and enjoy, no matter where it has its origin, it instantly becomes ours. But another statement is similarly, any idea, any person who comes from abroad and is ready to live the kind of life that people lead in India is instantly accepted as being Indian. India doesn't get enough credit for it because a lot of Indians are going everywhere in the world and they're traveling as a kind of modern Jew of the 20th century and 21st century. Indians are well known. But the fact is that there have been more immigration into India than almost any other country in the world. For one thing, tens of millions of Bangladeshis and so on. And, you know, even though people grumble about it and every time they're going to tighten the rules, you wouldn't see a kind of hysteria about it, as, for example, that's going on in the United States right now, or for that matter, in Britain, on which it's playing such a big part, even though the anger is often directed at Asian and African immigration, because most of them now come from EU, from European Union. But the anger is still there. Now, in some ways, that anger, they may yet come, but it hasn't been a traditional part of India at all. But the fact is, the four boundaries are porous between India and abroad, and it served India very well. I think Indian booming would not have come, but for the openness of the education sector, of the high-tech sector, and if the big booms particularly, but not only, the information technology as well as biochemical and medicinal thing had come very much in as a dialectic interaction with the West.
What has become of the village India that you knew growing up, that Gandhi and Nehru championed, that they located as the kind of core constituency of the country? What's replaced it? And how much do you miss it?
I can't miss it because you can't have a nostalgia for something which hasn't yet gone. In the sense, I mean, it would be odd to feel nostalgic because all you have to do is to walk out and there you are. Actually, I'm very lucky because the house that my father built about 100 miles off Calcutta, and this is in university town, which was established by Rabindranath Tagore, the poet. And I was born there, and I went to school there too, but my home is also there, and that's where I go. And all I have to do is to walk half a mile, and I will be in a very rural Bengal village.
They haven't all gone to Mumbai.
They haven't all gone to Mumbai, and they're very much there. And when I was very lucky when I got my novel and got some money, which I've never had before or after, for that matter. But I did use that money to start two trusts, one in India, one in Bangladesh. And they work mostly in the rural areas in India, and in East India in this case, and in Bangladesh. Bangladesh trust is mostly concerned with the gender inequity, but the Indian trust with basic education, basic healthcare, which is a huge problem. The villages are not gone, but the tragedy isn't so much that it's changing and going, but it's not changing and not going in the sense that we want villages, every village with schools. We want them with little bits of hospital and primary health care institution, access to good hospital, diagnostic arrangement. These things are not happening. So my grumble isn't that the Indian villages are changing. My grumble is that it's not changing fast enough. I'm nothing against village life, and I thoroughly enjoy when I go to Shantiniketan, and nothing could take away from me the pleasure one could get, and I don't get much chance to do it these days, getting on my bike and going, taking 15, 20 miles of bicycling through the rural area. Absolutely wonderful. But I would like to see dispensaries, primary health care, schools there. And that's not happening fast enough. That's my grumble. And sometimes when I complain that India is becoming bifurcated between half California and half sub-Saharan Africa, my complaint is that the line is unfortunately often rural and urban. And we have to... It's not just that, because there are a lot of poor people in the urban areas as well. It's a more complicated line. But rural-urban division is one of the big part of that division, which we have to bear in mind.
That's an important line you just slipped past. Half California, half sub-Saharan Africa. We'll come back to that. But would Nehru not be doing more for the villages today?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Nehru. But, you know, you have to take every person as he is. And the short answer is no, he wouldn't. Nehru was a quintessentially sympathetic, humane, liberated, enlightened urban boy who grew into, had good education in Harrow and at my college, Trinity College. He had a fine sympathy for the rural masses. He could link with Gandhiji, but his life wasn't there. Gandhiji's life very much was. But, you know, there was an elitism in him, which is not necessarily a bad thing. The Indian Institute of Technologies are, to a great extent, his creation, and that was elitism. Elitism has served India well, but at the same time, you have to do basic school and basic education. When the English left India, the British left India, the percentage of literacy in India was barely 10%. Mm. And it took such a long time. There was only one part of India which had a higher level of literacy, and that was a part of India that was outside the British rule, native kingdom of Travancore and native kingdom of Cochin. They had a higher level of literacy, among other reasons, because the kings there, in case of Travancore, the queen there, was very keen on basic education for all, including for women, making Rani Gauri Parvati Bai, making a great statement in 1814 about why it's extraordinarily important for women to be educated and everyone to be educated outside British India. So when the British left, British India was way below that. Kerala, which consists of Travancore, Cochin, and Malabar. Malabar was the part of Malayali speaking, which is Kerala's language, part of the Madras Presidency. It was attached. That was the most backward because it came from British India, not being part of independent kingdom of India. So when they were looked at, I remember being struck when I was in the 1950s, when I was myself in college, how striking the difference were between Travancore and Cochin on one side and Malabar on the other. It's a great thing about public policy, however, that this was in the 50s, and by the time you come to the 80s, beginning of 80s, when a friend of mine, Krishnan, T.N. Krishnan, worked on that, and showed that you cannot see any difference anymore. Mm. Public policy had eliminated it. So there is hope. You don't have to be born with great history to do it, to be able to prosper. You can change things. But I think the Nehru's own heart wasn't there. It wasn't part of the five-year plan. He always said that education is our priority. But there, school education is our priority, but with that statement, the policy more or less stopped. So I think we need, and for Gandhiji, it wasn't a big thing. There, I must say, Rabindranath Tagore, the poet, was the sole voice arguing that it's the educational, the backwardness of India, particularly illiteracy, which is the root, and this is more or less verbatim of Rabindranath Tagore, which is the root of nearly all the things that are wrong with India.
Mm. That was, and you knew Tagore, did you know it?
I knew him, yes, he named me. My mother was quite close to him, and she got a letter when I was one day old. You would be delighted to hear, I don't have any memory of it, but saying that it's bad that people use the same names again and again. I gather you have just had a son. He should be called by a new name, and here's one proposal. I hope you like it. And that's how Amartya came into the story. So, quite aside from the fact that I'm rather biased towards him, I think he was a great visionary in this respect. Gandhiji had a different kind of vision in political leadership which Tagore could not never have provided. Mm. On the other hand, Gandhiji's skepticism of formal education, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and science, is something that Tagore not only never shared, but he actually explicitly repudiated, argued with Gandhiji, and chastised Gandhiji for it. Some of the debates between Gandhi and Tagore, on which I've also tried to write, center around this.
When you think of great changes in India, what has changed more, after all, than its foreign policy? Its alignment with the United States, even in Afghanistan. This, the country that used to be such a thorn in the side of JFK, LBJ, peacenik, aggressively non-aligned in the world. What's your own take on the new Indian foreign policy?
Well, as a proud Indian citizen, and I should emphasize I am an Indian citizen, and only that, I'm critical of some parts of it. I'm supportive of many parts of it. The openness of India, its willingness to play ball with the world is very good. I think the issue of non-alignment has moved away with the Cold War's decline, so it's no longer a big issue. I think in its time it had great merit, but that's not the issue now. I think in the context of battle against terrorism, from which not only the United States and Europe, but also India suffers, Mumbai being one example, but we are everywhere we go in India, going to a hotel, you go through huge security. In any big establishment, you have this security. So there's a terrorist threat that is real in India, and it's real in other countries, including in Pakistan. In the American press, people are always talking about Pakistan generating terrorists, but they're also the ones who suffer most from the terrorists. Mm. Now, there is, you could say, as many Pakistani intellectuals have tended to argue, that there is almost a kind of bifurcation, in the almost schizophrenia in the Pakistani thinking about that. And that's for Pakistani citizens to deal with. And the Pakistani civil society, with very good newspapers, as they have, good radio coverage, television coverage, are trying to deal with that issue in a big way. They're very visionary leaders in Pakistan. My main complaint about America has been that when Americans had gone traditionally, it's changing but very slowly, they see the government people, see the military people, and completely ignore the civil society. And it's the civil society in which the hope of future of Pakistan lies. Mm. And I think in some ways the Indian diplomacy have also tended to concentrate too much on government and the military in the same way the Americans do. I think if I were criticize the Indian foreign policy, I think by and large most things I'm keen on. I think my differences are three. One, I think we should pay greater attention to civil society in Pakistan. Oddly, we do in Afghanistan. We don't get much credit for it. India spent more than $1 billion in construction and social welfare, social choice change project. It gets criticized, particularly by Pakistan government, on ground that this is an Indian infiltration. But that was that's a good move, actually, I think, because there's no question that Afghanistan needs a building of the social infrastructure. Secondly, I think when we had no power, India was to bore the whole world by lecturing how to behave. Krishnamurthy still holds the all-time record of the longest speech ever given in the United Nations, 14 hours non-stop. But when we were lecturing, we had no power. But now that we have a somewhat greater recognition, our ability to represent the interests of underdogs of society has to some extent declined. Mm-hmm. G20 has India as a big member, but the fact is that we don't raise the issue of Burma very much. We don't raise the issue of Africa a great deal. When we were fighting about the failed climate conference in Copenhagen, we have to talk not only about old polluters like Europe and America and the fact that they have occupied a very huge part, unusually huge part of the global commons. We have right to criticize it. We have right to say that Indian and Chinese and Brazilian industries should not be stifled by imposing a kind of mechanical symmetry. But we have to say something about not new polluters, but not non-old polluters, but non-polluters who someday will have to pollute if Africa turns to industrialization. It's India's role, I think, to represent them in G20, since they are not represented directly there. I think we've failed in that. I think we've failed also in not saying enough about Burma. I think India did a kind of pact with the devil there, in the sense that the military dictatorship is one of the most ruthless authoritarian regimes, and Aung San Suu Kyi, who was actually very close to India at one stage, has really not got much comfort from India recently. And she's too gracious a woman to grumble about it. Mm. But the fact is that that is the case. And the Indian made, clearly, as far as I can see, made a deal on the fact that the separatists in India and Northeast, who would often seek refuge in Burma, the Burmese military now dutifully sent them back to India to be arrested. In exchange, we don't holler there much. And, of course, the Chinese is a much bigger part of guilt, since they run pretty much the whole of the Burmese economy, and some Indians want to get a little share of that too, and that again cannot have priority over Indian interest in Burma. So these are two of the differences. The third difference, not worth discussing about, is that a lot of Indians are very keen on India being a member of the Security Council, permanent member. I don't really regard that as a big issue. There is some advantage in not having to express a view on every issue in the world. And so I think I don't really regard that to be such a big thing, though I can see why India feels neglected and why Britain and America and many other countries feel that Indians should definitely be there. I see the point. It's not a big issue for me, as it is for some others.
Sum it up in terms of where India is going in 10, 20, 30 years, maybe by the middle of the century. What is to prevent India from being, as you said, maybe jokingly, half California, half sub-Saharan Africa?
What is to prevent India from doing it is public discussion, public agitation, and what I generally call in my new book, The Idea of Justice, public reasoning. And one purpose of using catchphrase like half California and half sub-Saharan Africa. I've been saying these things for a long time, I can tell you.
We love them.
Well, thank you. But but people have now learned that unless you use a catchy phrase, which is quintessentially vulgar, because all catchy phrases are pretty vulgar, but you'd never get attention. The moment you do that, then suddenly all the newspapers put you on the headline saying India heading toward half California, half South Africa. I knew that, for example, when I was agitating about the neglect of Indian women, the fact that there were far fewer Indian women than you would expect in those days because of unequal health care. But that has, to a great extent, gone or certainly reduced. But what has come up is a new way in half of India, north and west, not so much still in south and east of India, that sex selective abortion leads to the abortion of female fetuses. Now, when I was talking about all these things, gender inequality, women's equal rights, they are like floating lead balloons in a public discussion. The moment when I gave a lecture and I did the calculation of missing women, yes. This didn't add any science. All it did was to put the numbers together and ask, had there been the same in India as in Europe, how many more more Indian women would be there. The answer was 30, more than 30 million. There were more than 40 then in China. So when the moment I said 30 million Indian women are missing, meaning that they were not born, I got the headline in all the Indian papers, 30 million Indian women missing, because it's a catchy phrase. So I now learned that if you have to, even if you can analyze something with sanity and lucidity and a modicum of intelligence, as I try to do, you have to also, presenting it to the public, find a phrase that others can repeat and put in headlines. And so we were fighting, and I don't think that is our future. I think it won't be ultimately. It's not a prediction. I said the way we are going, we would end up being half California and half sub-Saharan Africa. It's not a prediction, because that statement itself is a contribution to a much bigger force of agitation which wants to reverse it. And I think we shall overcome that. And when we do that, I don't think India will go up as half California and half sub-Saharan Africa.
We'll be with you in the public agitation. It's a huge pleasure, Amartya Sen, to hear an old-fashioned Indian wise man, if I may say. Oh, thank you so much.
Shame on you, but thank you.
Is that the wrong way to say it?
No, you did it exactly right.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.